Good morning, or shall I say mid-morning? This is Ruth Wittstein with the Bipolar Podcast. I haven't really decided a name yet. I know when I start to publish all of these, I will decide a name. What sounds good? Bipolar artist, bipolar nurse, a bipolar being. Once Upon a Time, My Unicorn. That's the name of my book, by the way. Once Upon a Time, My Unicorn. It is written by Ruth Wittstein, my name that I'm using, my pen name. And it is about my life. It's about when I discovered that I was a little different. And I kind of kept it under my hat. It is August 2nd. 2018. I stopped in the middle of that podcast yesterday because I was busy feeding dogs. And hold on a second. Drop a thing. There we go. I was busy feeding dogs and got very sidetracked working with what I did, and then of course family stuff and all of that. So, you know, you get busy with life, and I didn't have time to continue to talk and have a private place to do this. That's part of the issue of doing these podcasts, is finding privacy. It's something that I'm not including. My family knows I'm doing them. They know I'm doing them under my pen name. And they're supportive of me doing this, but they prefer me to keep their personal names out of it. And I totally agree. You know, I don't really want the universe to know. I don't want them to see my daughter's face, my husband's face, my eldest daughter's face. You know, I don't want that at this point in time, because it isn't fair. This is my life being talked about here. So yesterday I started talking about, you know, I hadn't discussed my kiddom, call it my kiddom, but you know, up until the age of 15, it was pretty normal for me. Well, you know, honestly, there's a history there, to be truthful. I grew up in a northern state, we won't say where. Remember I told you that when I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, it came as a surprise to my family, but not really to me, because of, you know, when you go in for a diagnosis, if you have a really good doctor, and I did, he was really thorough. He went over family stuff, because he was very interesting. He was affiliated with Research Hospital too, and I'm not going to discuss his name because I'm protecting him as well, but very good doctor. And he believed in the strong genetic or the hereditary history of bipolar disorder. He believed that it ran in families, and he could find me talking about what my life was like as a child, that there's a very strong possibility that my father was bipolar, and that we all knew that my eldest brother was bipolar. My eldest brother, actually, I haven't heard or seen from, oh gosh, in a very long time. My eldest daughter was, I want to say, 3 months old the last time I saw him, my eldest brother. And she just turned 30, so that's a really long time to not see a family member. We kind of are like that in my family, though, my extended family. We tend to go off and we'll go 10 years without talking or seeing each other. There might be some lines dropped, you know, from time to time. We might actually, you know, keep in touch via the mail right now, and there is a reason. Excuse me. Had a little trouble sleeping last night. Well, actually, I had a little trouble falling asleep. And once I fell asleep, it was like the best sleep ever. And then I didn't want to get up, that kind of sleep, you know, the kind that you just feel like, oh, you know, you just, everything's perfect. And if you get up, you're going to just totally disrupt your cocoon. And I'm still kind of in that state. It's nearly 11 a.m. for crying out loud. But I am a night person, folks. Both with my work and I'm, you know, if you have bipolar, I'm going to say this again, you know what it is to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and just be awake, don't you? You're just awake for whatever reason. You know, it's very important you try to get your sleep. You know, my doctor always said you just really need to work on getting that 8 hours if you can. She said, you know, six is doable, but if you can strive for 8, you know, that's fabulous. I never really got the 8 hours sleep. I got 6. I would consider okay doable would be 3 to 4 hours of sleep. And if I got 6 hours of sleep, I felt like I had accomplished great things, you know, because, you know, but anyways, where am I going with all this? I'm getting off track. Back to my doctor. Let's just go back to that. Let's go back to when I was diagnosed when I was 32 and I went through all this paperwork. And I say paperwork because he had lots of questions for me to ask. And he put me in a room, which I need. He asked me some things and then he put me in a room. He says, I just want you to write. Here's some paper and here's questions. And I just want you to write your story to me. Tell me what you were as a kid. Tell me about you. I want you to talk to me about what makes you think there's something wrong with you. Tell me about your childhood. You know, he said there's some questions in here. Go through the questions first, and then you can do the essays after that. And we mean essays. We mean just, you know, like just paragraphs about what it was like to be a kid inside your house. He said, I'm not looking for laying blame here. He said, I'm not hunting down to point fingers at parents and say they're terrible people. That's what I'm not doing here. He said, what I'm doing is I'm trying to help figure out how this all can fit in and better serve you to fix you and also help you come to terms with that. So, and he said, and if you want to include your family at some point in this, that would be great. Because if there is some issues there that might help them, you know, he said, but that's all on their terms too. He said, you cannot ever force a person into therapy. You just can't. So this was the beginning process. I mean, he blocked off a whole hour to be with me. Hour and a half, I think. It was a long session. I know he saw somebody else while I was working on the paperwork. He really wanted me to open up, and his idea was to, if I wrote it down and I was by myself, to think that I would probably be more honest than as if I would speak the answers to him. You see, that's a really good way of doing it, I think. It lets you, without, you see, sometimes I think some people have what they call performance anxiety, if you heard of that, you know, where you're put on the spot and you just don't know how to answer those questions. And he said, I could do it either way. He said, but something tells me you'd feel a whole lot better just sitting there to answer these. So he gave me the book. He gave me the questions, gave me the paper. He said, have at it. You're a nurse too. He says, you're no doubt proficient in taking family histories, right? And I said, oh yeah, that's what I do. You know, I take care of patients, of course, but I'm always taking care of family histories and what have you. And I take writing them down you know, asking lots of questions. And he said, okay, and you're used to writing the answers down? He said, so go ahead. Do what you're good at, but do it on yourself. So I did. And he left me in that room for about 40 minutes. And while I was in there, you know, he made good time for himself, I'm sure. He went and saw other patients and what have you. And every once in a while, he'd pop his head in and he'd say, hey, you doing good? I said, yeah. You done yet? Or do you want me? He said, I'm not rushing you. I'm going to go see somebody else here. And he said, do you need more time? I said, yeah, actually I do. And he goes, that's fine. Take your time. No rush. Do you want a coffee? Would you like something to drink? I mean, he was the nicest person. So I sat there and did that, drank the coffee, had long thoughts. Even went out for a smoke. He knew I smoked cigars. He didn't judge me on that. I've been working. That's my vice, folks. I'm back and forth between my cigar smoking, little mini cigar smoking and not smoking. And he let me step outside for a minute and come back in. And I mean, he was very, very non-rushed, very, very relaxed situation. I answered all his questions. Finally went back into his study, and he looked at everything. He was going through it quietly, and he said, why don't you go take a break, go to the bathroom, and I'll see you back here in about 10 minutes. He said, give me some time to look over everything. Maybe 15 minutes, he said. We're not in a massive rush today. He was just so relaxed. Really kind of miss him. If I had the insurance, I would be seeing him again. He was a very good man. Very non-threatening. He knew how to talk to people. Knew how to make not feel on the spot. So anyhow, I went out for a little bit. Went to the little snack bar. And a little snack bar in this office building. It's the nicest little place. And they just knew what they were doing. So anyways, 15, 20 minutes later, I come back in. Talk to the reception. She says, oh yeah, he's waiting back there for you. So he sat down. He goes, okay now. He said, well, what I can see here, based on what I have looked at your parents, mostly your father. He said, I see you have a brother here, possibly a sister. Not sure about the sister. Definitely you. He said, I see bipolar disorder. And he said, I don't like to use that word disorder so much. He said, I'm going to say, I see bipolar. He said, your symptoms, when you were tracking them here for me, showing me what you saw, I mean, you're very good at writing these down. I mean, I was having some problems before then. You know, as I told you, my coworkers were the ones that helped me see that I need to go. They're the ones that made the decision, but helped me see that I needed help. Sorry. And I think without them, without their aid, you know, I would have gone in there. I would have still continued to fly around like I was, possibly lose my job. If you're hearing that noise, that's my lighter. I'm sorry, folks. Yes. Naughty, naughty Ruth still smokes her cigars. I don't smoke as many as I used to. I used to smoke almost 3/4 of a pack a day, if not a pack a day. And I smoke maybe just a few in the morning when I'm doing this or when I'm writing. Never smoke inside. Do not smoke around my child. I do not put that on her. My husband also smokes, but he also, same just like me, only in the morning, always outside, never around the child, because we don't believe it's her fault that we like to smoke our cigarettes or our cigars. Okay, so back to this thing. I told you my friends, and I consider them my friends, my coworkers, ones that helped me get in there and get some help. And at that point in time when I went to go see him, I was in a somewhat better state. You know, I was beginning, I believe, to start to go into the hypomania, not quite there yet, but I was moving in that direction, we'll say. And I had just come out of the depression, being home for over a week and a half in bed. And I explained to him the reason I was there, because of my job was on the line, you know, and my head nurse was like, you need help. you need help. We got to figure this out, you know, because I can't cover for you with administration. They're coming down on us with all these call-ins all across the board, everybody. You know, and I explained that to him. I said, you know, I just couldn't get out of bed. You know, my daughter was like on autopilot at that point. She was getting herself ready for school in the morning and breakfast and I'll get on the bus and get out, you know, go and because like I had my daughter when I was 23. I got diagnosed when I was 32. So she was old enough to get up and pour her breakfast and she would, you know, have a bowl of cereal. And I, you know, she had her alarm. She was way more organized than me. And she'd be on that bus. And there are many times that I'd call her in the morning, her dad, when he did stay, or I did have a babysitter or the neighbor lady that would come over, spend the night, or she would spend the night over at the neighbor's when I worked nights, you know. My daughter would get up in the morning and, you know, she had her alarm and get her shower. She was so organized, unlike me. Breakfast, all this kind of stuff, and off to go to school. So my being in bed for a week and a half was not a problem. And I had money, you know, believe it or not, even though I was a little wild with the money, that's the other thing too. He covered that, my spending problems. God knows I had them. I was in debt up to my eyeballs, but I still had money. I still managed to have some cash flow from all the extra shifts I would work. You know, I did a lot of extra overtime when I was manic. And so, you know, would I say, would I use that money to pay the debt? No, I a lot of times would just squirrel it away and pay the minimum on the debt. And then when I have these moments where I couldn't get out of bed, you know, I could order food. And I lived in the city, so I'd order food and they would, you know, bring it to the house and she'd be set. She had the best of pizza, Chinese, you name it, because we had it all around us, you know. And I felt bad. I thought I wasn't very good at it, but at least this is what my psychiatrist told me. Let me get back to this whole thing. When he saw my pattern of what was going on, the pattern of the motor mouth, talking like 90 miles an hour, rapid speech, working many, many days, no sleep. In addition to somewhat magical thinking. Now, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's kind of like delusions of grandeur. And it's the fact that you're damn near a superhero, and I felt like it. I felt like I was a superhero. I felt like I could... when I was in that state, there wasn't an IV I couldn't get. I worked in an intensive care unit. There wasn't an ART stick I couldn't get. ART stick, arterial stick, to get arterial blood gases. I worked in an intensive care unit. They were calling me all over the place, and I'm not kidding, to draw blood, to put IVs in, because I couldn't miss anything. It was like I felt it. It was like superhero. I felt like a superhero. And I mentioned that in the paperwork, that I felt like sometimes I was bestowed upon this great gift when I was in this burst of energy, that I could do these amazing things. You know, get the IVs in, get the arterial sticks, do all this stuff that everybody else seemed to be struggling with. You know, even put breathing tubes in. There was a moment where the physician that was there couldn't get the endotracheal tube in this child. And everybody went, ha, you know, tell her to do it. Let Ruth do it. Because, I mean, she's Miss... They inflated my ego a little bit, which is probably not the best thing. But, you know, I walked over there and I put some tubes in, breathing tubes in my career. But, you know, it was not something that the nurses did on a regular basis. And Dr. Hanneman, laryngoscopy, said, go for it. He said, because this kid needs a tube. We can't bag him and ask him forever. I said, okay. I said, I'll do the best I can. I said, I really feel it though. I think I can. Slipped it right in. See, so it was like my confidence level was so good. I had no doubts in myself. And that is something that my doctor told me that a lot of times goes along with this bipolar disorder, was that Your confidence level is over the top. You know, and confidence, good confidence in yourself is paramount to achieving your goals too. You know, I wasn't totally full of myself. I really wasn't. I was just like, they kept calling on me to do things and I just kept getting them. And in my mind, I was saying, I didn't say it out loud. In my mind, I was saying to myself, I am touched by something here. And I told the doctor that. I said, I felt like that. You know, my rational mind wants to say, once I come down off that high of the euphoria, that I was, what was that all about? That was just a momentary glitch. But these momentary glitches just kept happening, you know, for a week or two at a time. And then a month of depression, you know. The speed of which I would do things at and all that. And he did ask if it was okay to talk to a couple of my people that I worked with, you know, of what my behavior was, not out to get me, but to help me. But it was a very good experience in the beginning. It can turn sour though, folks, if you're not lucky enough to have the support system I had there. Which, you know, I was extremely lucky to have the people I had. So anyways, we went through all that. And then the childhood stuff. I, of course, didn't manifest my symptoms until I was 15. Before that, you know, we talked about my father suddenly losing it and deciding to pack up the family and go to our cabin that was way, way north. Because he thought the end was coming. My daddy was a professional professor, smart man. And then all of a sudden, and he would be very, very energetic and, you know, he would take us on shopping sprees and make my mother nervous. I can remember my mother being scared as he would buy us whole wardrobes of clothes that were really expensive at one of the most expensive department stores. My father would do things like this and scare my mother to death. I can remember as a kid hearing the arguments and then trying to walk in on them and they'd say, go, go, go. You know, you don't worry about this. This isn't stuff for you to worry about. You know, there'd be that kind of stuff going on. And then there'd be this all of a sudden, you know, my mother'd be like, okay, you know, you're out of school now for a month. I'm like, what? How can we be out of school for a month? You know, I'm in the sixth grade. My dad's already made phone calls. He's packed our shit. I had no idea this was going on. In the morning, you know, my father would be, you know, either knocking on the doors when we were, you know, sixth grade and above. Or when we were littler, I can remember being carried by him to the car in the middle of the night as they were going to the cabin to hide. My mother, of course, you know, having this feeling of, I don't know what this is all about. We'll just go with it. And, you know, she packing up all the kids. And we thought, great, you know, got some time off of school, right? I became versed at doing my schoolwork from the house. Because that was going on. And then I started manifesting some odd symptoms when I was 15. But in the very beginning, my father would do this stuff, you know. And so that's what he said was, is it was that behavior of extreme spending, paranoid. The world was coming to an end. Took off and run, hide for months at a time. And then, you know, daddy's calling in sick. Daddy can't get out of bed. Daddy's bad. His back is out. That was what we were told. Oh, his back is bad. My mother would cover for him. His office, you know, they never questioned his shit for some reason because he was such a, I want to say, decorated teacher. He was professor. They didn't give him any crap about it until the ultimatum came, and I was in high school when that happened, and I was starting to manifest my own damn symptoms of wanting to sleep all the time, and like I told you, massive amounts of work I would get done. I was accelerated classes, I was ahead of everybody else pretty much, and, you know, I would work real hard, get away ahead, have all this energy, you know, be doing homework at 2 a.m, not be tired, sleep an hour and a half, go to school, and that'd be going on for like a couple of weeks, and then all of a sudden, boom, I can't handle it. I couldn't get out of bed. Nothing was ever talked about except, you know, I did go to the pediatrician's office, and she just said, oh, this is normal teenagerhood. This is what was said to my mom. A lot of teenagers do this. She mentioned that my father was like this, and she said, well, I wouldn't worry too much about it. She'll probably grow out of it. Well, I didn't. It only got worse. And what I say by worse is that then it was my turn to be in charge of the household, you know, once I moved out, graduated, all those things, and had my job, and ended up being married and having, you know, family, one child, first child, and my behavior starting to, you know, come out of the closet big time of that first. And then, of course, and I would just, and my husband, my first husband, just couldn't deal with this. I don't blame him 100% for what happened. We could have talked it out, but we were so young. I mean, I graduated from nursing school when I was 20. And then I'm out there working, right? And doing a job that a lot of 20-year-olds wouldn't be doing, right? You know, I had a college degree already. My husband at the time was trying to go to college because he didn't graduate like I did. He was older than me. There was a little competition there in him. He had a little problem with the fact that I graduated before he did, as far as being able to just go to work. It was a bit of a blow to his ego. But then he kind of rode with it because I was making the money, man, you know? And that's really, that was awesome to him. Oh, wow, she's money bags. So anyhow, you know, and then by the time my daughter was 2, with this vacillating behavior that I had, and he, in realizing that his heart wasn't in our relationship, my heart wasn't in our relationship either. I was so busy working and this and that, and then all my days off, trying very hard to be a mom, and it wasn't the easiest thing because of my symptoms that were beginning to be out of control. And then finally, you know, like I said, when I was 32, fast forward, already go through the divorce, and then I turned 32. You know, I think 10 years went by, me flying by the seat of my pants, trying to work, trying to make it. My friends all helping me. We all helping each other because we had a lot of single parents, single moms working. A lot of your nurses out there are single parents. Pat those nurses on the back, would you? On their backs, because they work their asses off to take care of you. And sometimes I feel like nurses are underappreciated because they're doing stuff in the wake of family, their own personal health, and they're taking care of other people's personal hells. It's, you know, and you have to do that. You have to check your personal stuff at the door when you walk into the nursing world. Anybody does, but I mean, as far as that, you know, when you're taking care of patients and innocent lives, you have to check your personal stuff at the door because that's not their get. That's not the, they're having enough problems. So anyways, we're all helping each other, you know, and watching each other's kids. But then, like I said, my behavior at that place I was working, what brought it on was my head nurse really noticed that pattern of me working 6 back-to-back 18-hour shifts. Who does that? Night shifts. 6 days in a row of 18-hour nights. My ex did help me watch my child during that time. Or or she came to work with me. You know, I always had care. So but that was, and then after I do that 6, I might be off a day or 2, maybe work 1, and then, oh my gosh, I couldn't handle it. Now, people might say, well, you just got exhausted. And I even tried to kind of argue with the doctor when he said, no, your symptoms. He said, you're spending. That was another thing I did on days off. Like if I had worked my schedule to where I would work 3 days on, 3 days off, that was one of the things that we decided, that I wasn't allowed to work any more of these long stretches. I could work 3 or 4 12s in a row and then have 3 days off. All my days off. Kept my night schedule. My daughter kind of was half on that night schedule, and we would spend loads of money. And I mean loads of money. I loved shopping. I had credit cards. I just kept filling them out. I would make the minimum payments. They love that, by the way, when you make those minimum payments. That's all you ever do. Shoot. I had probably 10 or 12 credit cards. Well, anyways, you know, he went over all that, and he went over my father's symptoms, and my brother, who, when I can remember last time I saw him, he was acting pretty out, very, very, very hyper, and behaving very obvious, according to what my doctor said. And he said, look, he said, I know this is hard to hear, he said, but this is what I think is wrong. He said, and look, because of what you've been able to accomplish, let's not say this is what's wrong with you. Let's say this is what you have, and now we need to deal with it in a way that is helpful to you. Let's harness this. Let's make it so it's not a hindrance, because he said, if we don't get you some care, he said, you know, these days where you get into this depression where you can't get out of bed, he said, you can't keep a job like that. You know, they will eventually fire you. And he said, I don't care how good, you know, you got it there as far as your, he said, I promise you, he said, they can't keep it going. He was right. My headmaster was already talking to me about that. She said, look, she said, I know when you're here, you're exceptional, but when you're not here. And administration is coming down on people who call it. So, anyway, fast forward to the medications. He put me on lithium and started me off on a low dose, which was 300 milligrams of the lithium carbonate every night. And I took it. It took about 2 weeks. I still felt kind of off and weird. And actually, once that kicked in, I felt pretty good. Things started to get pretty normal. And I trucked along for a while like that. They let me stay on that lithium dose probably for 6 months. And then the blood levels, they had to do blood levels, and then they, oh, it's not therapeutic. So then they wanted to increase it. And as they increased it, that's when I started having trouble. You see. And part of me almost wanted to stop taking it because I was feeling so good. I was feeling so normal. I was able to go to bed and get up and have life and do this and do that, you know, and not, I could resist that urge to blow $3,000 at one time, because I used to do that. When I start to get energetic, it seemed like, or that hypomania would come, it seemed like I could reel it in, you know. Well, anyhow, due to blood levels, you know, it wasn't good enough. And that's where our beautiful relationship began to not dissolve, but we started to have a few arguments. He switched me around on some different medications. It was a rocking and a rolling thing. I came off the lithium at some point, and he put me on Zyprexa, which was terrible. Destroyed my, I ended up with type 2 diabetes. I don't know if that's what truly caused it, because my mother had a history of it, but I was, suddenly having, feeling terrible, and, you know, how can I explain it, what a high blood sugar feels like, you know, almost felt drunk. And so, since that was one of the side effects, you know, he sent me to the lab to get blood work done. Lo and behold, my blood sugars were out of control. Well, then they put me on metformin. We entered into another physician, you know, a family care physician, you know, and they worked together on my medications and stuff. Pretty soon, started having cholesterol issues. I mean, it kind of started to mushroom out of control. And then in that lovely mix, I started to have lots of aches and pains and misery in my body. Couldn't figure out what that was. And they drew some blood work and discovered, oh my goodness, you have lupus. Let's add that to the fun, lupus. Yeah. So, and then I was put on a bunch of meds for that. And this is all a blur, the medication part, guys. Because suddenly, you know, I'm trucking along 7-8 years, barely making it. What I thought was I had to do all this. I had to take all these drugs and everything in order, because, you know, you hear from different various physicians that if you didn't stay on this treatment plan, you're going to die. They didn't actually come, well, they just said you could wind up in the hospital, especially with the lupus. You know, I had to stay on all these medications. And then, of course, the medications for the bipolar, and I suddenly just had a moment where I had had enough. I was nearly 400 pounds, 373 pounds overweight. When I started being treated for bipolar disorder, I was like 140 pounds. And over the course of about 8 years, 10 years of that treatment for bipolar and the lupus, I started to gain weight. In addition to, with the lupus, having sick episodes, you know, getting sick and stuff and having to stay home, it was one of those situations where I had to switch jobs. Well, then my support system was gone. So, you know, you don't really tell everybody about all your personal problems. I still went ahead and continued the treatment, but it was hard. Different group of people. I should have stayed in touch with my peeps. I really didn't. The new peeps, friends, whatever you want to call them, coworkers, didn't really understand all the things that were going on with me. My relationship with my psychiatrist, who I loved so dearly in the beginning, switched to medication management. And as that's what it always does, you see. It was like, okay, well, we need to switch this med out. You need to take this now. We're going to go ahead and put you on some mood stabilizers. I think it was on Lamictal. I think I was on quite a few. I was on anti-anxiety drugs to deal with the sudden panic attacks I would have, which apparently is something that's normal when you're on Zyprexa. It was getting to the point where I was waddling around, and even people who hadn't seen me in a while when they saw me, finally, we're like, what happened to you? No offense, but, you know, where's this happy person? You're now, I said, I know, fat, huge, nearly 400 pounds. I was, you know, I went from a size medium in clothing to 4X. And I just felt terrible all the time. Moon face from the steroids, from the lupus, you know, and all that. And, well, anyhow. I had an epiphany that I felt like this was not serving me well, and I started to slowly back off my medications. They switched me back on the lithium again. That was a thing too. Let's try the lithium again. Let's take you off the Zyprexa. Let's put you on the lithium. So we tried that. Couldn't get the dosage right according to what he wanted, because I started to feel better. Here's the thing, on a lower dose, and he's like, no, we got to keep these levels. And so it was like the argument. Remember earlier in the earlier podcast, I said it was not really an argument, but it was a disagreement of beliefs of where I needed to be. And I said, you know, look at me, just look at me. You know, when I first started seeing you, I was 140 pounds, and I wasn't that. Oh, that's your lupus now. That could be what's causing it. No, I think it's a combo of problems here. Yes, the lupus, the medications for that, and then, of course, you know, this flip-flopping on the medicines for my bipolar, and now that I'm back on the lithium, we're disagreeing on the fact that I feel great at 300 milligrams in the evening, and I don't get out of control. But your levels, I just kept focusing on the blood levels, and that's when I just said, okay, fine. And I went home, and then I guess I had a moment where, and I think it was when I started to go completely off the meds on my own. Bipolar meds, not the other ones. I walked in, gave him the slip, and said, "You're fired." That's what I did. I literally fired my psychiatrist. And they were like, "Whoa," you know. And I don't remember that, see. I was in a fog. It was a really bad time. And then also, and I was trying to keep my job, trying so hard. They had moved me into a lesser intense area of the NICU because they knew something was wrong with me. But they didn't, you know, they didn't know everything, see. They just thought it was the lupus that was causing me grief. And I didn't really talk to them about my bipolar. I just kept that shit under my hat, literally. And so anyhow, I was moved into a lesser intense area, much easier cares, which was good. I got to tell you, whenever I would feel bad or feel like I couldn't handle something, I would always call somebody over to help me. I never compromise the care of my patients. That's something that I'm going to say I pat myself on the back for. I never let my illnesses, either one, the bipolar or the lupus, compromise my care. If I didn't feel good about something, if I was so concerned for the others, so concerned for the innocent little lives I had in my hands, that I would call in sick before I would endanger a life. That's how I felt. I would make sure I was okay, and I would always ask for second opinions on things before I would do something. And that was the other thing that led to realizing that I needed to make some changes too, is that with that one medication that I was on, the Zyprexa, it was causing me to have memory loss and having me and have literally have just questioning myself repeatedly. And one of the nurses, I did make a friend, she was very sweet. I won't mention her name, but we'll call her Lucy. Miss Lucy. She was so sweet. She said, "Babe, I know something's wrong with you because you are so paranoid about yourself. You don't trust yourself." And she says, "My gosh, you know, you came to us as a decorated NICU nurse and you seem so unsure of yourself. What can I do to help you?" And I just said, "Can you just stand here with me and help me with these things?" And I am having problems. I think it's the lupus. You know, it can hurt your brain, which, you know, I you know, it can hurt your brain. Lupus, I had a systemic lupus erythematosus. I have. That's the kind that can affect your brain. So, you know, I wasn't completely wrong. I just said, "You know, I'm having problems with these medications that they've got me on for the lupus, and it is affecting some of my judgment." And I said, "I really need a support person here to make sure that I'm doing okay." I said, "These children don't need to suffer because I can't do the job right. And I've got to feed my child. I don't want to lose everything here, you know." Of course, my child now was growing up. She was nearly leaving the house. Okay. So it was really more of not wanting to lose everything. She was in high school and she was basically on her way out the door, you know. So she was on autopilot. But I just felt like I didn't want to lose my job, and I didn't want to lose, didn't want these kids to suffer because of me. So that right there, you know, she just said, "Well," and she said something to me. She goes, "Well, if you feel bad about what's going on with you, maybe it's time for a second opinion. Maybe it's time for you to find a different doctor. How long have you been seeing these doctors?" I mean, it was a lot, you know, going on 8 years. And she says, "Maybe you're at a standstill with them. Maybe you need a fresh approach." So I did get a fresh approach. I went all natural for everything. I had fired the psychiatrist. I got to where I felt like even the lupus drugs were getting me. Fired them too. And then I just went and found myself a general practitioner to deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, which I had, and thyroid disorder, which I had. And we didn't discuss the bipolar. We didn't talk about that. I flew by the seat of my pants again with the bipolar, and I stopped talking about the lupus. Now, that's crazy, but you can do that, you know. When you switch doctors, you can just fill out paperwork and decide you don't want people to know this stuff, and I did that. okay, so we just concentrated on those issues, and I researched lupus, and I did the best I could to stay out of the sun, to reduce my stress, to this, to that, you know. And then as far as my psychiatric issues, the bipolar, I decided that I was going to have to find something in the natural world that would fix this. Because there's a stigma about bipolar also. I did run into a situation. I ran into a situation early on. And I never forgot it. And then, of course, it happened again when I had a panic attack. But I didn't realize that's what it was. It felt like a heart attack. While I was on these medications, I divulged my medications when I went to the emergency room. I went in there with chest pain, shortness of breath, all the classic signs of a heart attack, and the doctor was going down my list of meds. This was the second time this happened to me. And he comes to the psychiatric meds, and he asked me, what's this for? And I just told him it was for my bipolar, and he just, oh. Okay then. And then he removed the patches off my chest for the cardiac, took the oxygen out of my nose, and said, you just need to go home and take your anti-anxiety pills and go to bed. That's the end of my cardiac test, you know, I mean, of being tested for cardiac problems. And I looked at him, I said, sir, I'm having a hard time breathing. The oxygen helps the pain in my chest, which as a nurse, I know that that means it could be cardiac. Oh, well, you think it might be cardiac. He didn't listen to me. He passed me off as a head case and sent me home with chest pain, which I worked through and then later on discovered, get this, I had what they call a silent MI. It is possible to have one of those. Silent myocardial infarction. Well, that wasn't so silent because I had chest pain. The infarcts showed up. The damage showed up on the EKG. It was there. And the cardiologist that saw it said, wow, looks like here you've had an infarct. You've had at some point here and within the last year or so, based on what I'm reading here. And of course they did an echocardiogram after that too. And they saw some damage that had been done to my heart. And I explained to him what happened. And he just went, oh my God. I said it was an ER doctor, you know, he didn't take me seriously because I'm on these meds. He just shook his head and he said that, and it was a busy night. He goes, don't excuse that. Don't excuse the busy night. He said, this happens more times than you think. People with mental illness that go in for true physical illnesses get passed off as crazy by the staff, and send you home, and here you are. You're really sick. Yeah. So I went on some medication for a while for my heart. I can't remember what it was because it was only a short-term stint that I had to be on it. And, you know, I could have probably gone after this ER doctor, sued him, because the damage was permanent. I still have a little bit of a problem with, I have an arrhythmia in my heart now from that episode. And, but I'm really not a vindictive person, so I didn't go after him, but I probably should have. I should have made him accountable because, you see, I suffered something that I didn't need to suffer, all because of the stigma of mental illness. So then it led me to not tell the truth, you see. Then that wanted me to then take myself off those meds also. Don't want to take those meds. Don't want people to think of me as broken, sick, whatever, so they'll take me seriously. Now, that's pretty sad. So there might be some people out there that don't get their mental illnesses taken care of because they are so afraid of not being taken seriously by anyone, including medical staff, you know? So that's just, I don't know what to say about that. I'm hoping things have changed. Now, I've told you I've had to change, fast forward to now, the way things are now, I've changed because I'm on all natural treatments. I have no stress. Let me put it like this. I live in a stress-free environment right now. I no longer work, you know, forcing myself to have to be the breadwinner. When I don't feel good, I can take the time to feel better. because I have such a great man in my life, and our relationship is good, and I have some support people online. I do seek out support groups, and I'm journaling my journey through bipolar, and all my, you know, basically writing an autobiography of myself. And I do believe the name of it is going to be Once Upon My Unicorn. That doesn't sound right. Once Upon My Unicorn. Basically, it's when I believed, when I was 15, back when I had the magical thinking, I believed that unicorns existed. And, you know, with all the weird symptoms of me sleeping all the time and then having all these bursts of energy and doing tons of schoolwork, suddenly, I'm believing in unicorns and fairies, okay, 15 years of age. And I stole my mother's wedding dress. This is back when I was 15. We were living up at the farm in a northern state, beautiful place. And had lots of forest around it, and I was just convinced that there were unicorns in that forest. It was a magical looking place. I mean, anybody that would have seen it would like be the poster child for that movie Legend. Remember that movie Legend with Tom Cruise and Mia Sara about unicorns? Okay, the forest was like that. It was gorgeous, mossy ground, you know, beautiful big tree. Okay, I was convinced there was a unicorn out there. I thought I'd seen one. Took my mom's wedding dress and me being this 15-year-old virgin on a night where the full moon was. I put this wedding dress on, beautiful dress, looked like a medieval dress, and took off into the middle of the woods. I did this when everybody was asleep, but midnight. And I ended up out there, and I saw my unicorn drinking out of a stream. I certainly did. And he looked at me. That was the delusion. It was the actual hallucination, I believe. And he was out there in the woods, and I saw fairies. And no, I didn't take any drugs, and no, I wasn't on any kind of, I wasn't drinking, because I didn't do that. I saw that. And then I fell asleep watching this beautiful thing by the moonlight, because I had a little lantern with me. I lived on a farm. We had kerosene lanterns and stuff like that. And I fell asleep under a tree, only for my father to wake me up the next morning at about 10. He was retired at that time. At 10, he's like, "Hey, what are you doing out here in the woods, you know, in your mother's wedding dress?" And I told him, and he gets me back into the house. And then after that period, after that moment when I had that hallucination, if you will, psychosis, I slept for 2 weeks again. And this pattern just kept going, you know, and they just let me get away with it. There really wasn't good therapies back then for people like me. I don't think there was. I don't. I think it was a misunderstood disorder. I think it's still misunderstood. I think there's a lot to be learned about bipolar disorder and how to treat it even. I think everybody's treatment should be individual. I think that your medications should be definitely individual. I think your blood levels, like if you're going to take lithium, should be an individual situation. It shouldn't just go solely on your levels, okay? It should also go on your feelings, your behavior, your what, you know, do you get really manic on this dose? Okay, well, if you don't get that manic, what are you accomplishing when you start to come down off the mania? What happens? Are you sleeping for 2 weeks at a time, or are you still productive? Are you still doing things, but you're not, you're just kind of, you know, not necessarily full-blown just depression, but, you know, are you, that's kind of how I feel like they need to do that now that I've been away from psychiatric care and literally going it alone and going natural. I have been able to tweak my lithium orotate to what works for me, and I can do it. I'm not saying everyone can, though, and so that's once again, I'm going to say this, please do not embark on all natural cares without knowing what you're doing, okay? I've had years of research capability as a nurse. You know, despite all the things that I had going wrong with me, with my illness and everything, I knew how to do research, and I'm not saying that the average person can't, but please don't harm yourself. I am not telling you to do this. This is my story for me, what I am doing. I do believe, though, that when you go see a doctor, if it's a psychiatrist, and if I do embark upon another psychiatrist again someday, that psychiatrist is going to have to meet me halfway. We are going to have to be in this together. I'm going to have some say-so in my treatment, you know, because everybody's an individual. And maybe the low blood level of lithium in you, maybe if it's low or subtherapeutic, maybe that's not true for you. Maybe subtherapeutic levels are therapeutic for you. See, maybe you or me, for example, operate on a lower level than most. See, and my symptoms might not be as bad. You reduce a lot of stress in your life. You take away a lot of the hardcore responsibility that you might have to have. Maybe you, tons and tons of responsibility with this disorder is not really for you, and that's okay. You know, if I have to go back into the work world, here's the thing, and I'm not saying that being a clerk in a store is less responsible than being a nurse, but I won't be saving lives. I won't be having this innocent life in my hands anymore. Let's say I go back. Let's say the writing thing doesn't work out and I go back into the work world someday here, because I am getting a little itching to work. It's been about 6-7 years since I've been a nurse, and sometimes I miss working. But let's say that you do that, right? You go back into the work world, or you change your job. Let's say you're in a very high-stress job and you move into something less stress, but it still works for you. Financially, it can be hard because you need to have something that can carry you. Now, I'm fortunate today. I have someone that helps me. All right. And I think symptoms can be managed very well if you reduce the stress is what I'm after. Now, there's something I want to embark into is that I do meditation, but I don't know about the transcendental meditation. I've read about that. That is supposed to help when you become manic. It helps center you. And I like to move into that realm of meditation. There are other things you can do besides popping pills. You know, I'd like to see more doctors try to find ways that are cognitive therapies and this and that, rather than just only relying on the medication. Because it seems sometimes like with this disorder and some of the other mental illnesses, it's here's a pill, take your meds, don't get off your meds. And I get that. I have to stay on my lithium, the dosages that I'm on. I'm here to tell you folks, if I don't take this, if I run out, if it's like, you know, if I miscalculate, because I have, where I've gone a week where I haven't had it, oh, let me tell you something. It's not fun to be around me. So you need, if you have a disorder like this, you need some elemental help. What that elemental help is going to have to be researched and found out between you and your doctor. Yeah. I did know what was best for me. Lithium worked the best for me. You know, and they always say they don't want to keep you on it long term, but I think low dose lithium is great. I do. It's great stuff. I think that you can get everything else from cognitive therapy. For me, I'm not saying that other people can, you know. I've had situations where I have those paranoid moments, and I know that people with bipolar have. They get the paranoid moments where they think everybody's watching them. Like just recently, and this is where I realized I hadn't had my medications in the right time, or my herbs, my elements, or whatever. I wasn't taking them at the right time, and I was actually taking things at the same time. I find it's better if you can have an hour and a half window between medications. They tend to work better. You know, taking a handful of pills, you know, if you read on that, the pharmacology, you're going to find out that they sometimes fight each other inside your body, you know. So cramming a handful of pills may not be your best bet. You know, try to spread things out a little bit so that your body can go, oh yeah, here it is. I know what to do with it now. But if you put everything in your body at once, poor body has to try to figure out how to put things where it needs to go. And let's face it, pharmacologically and biologically, there's an argument sometimes going on inside your body, and the one thing that you might need might not get where it needs to go because you've taken two things together that are arguing with each other. That is a fact of biology. So splitting your meds up, you know, separating them out by a couple hours can really be beneficial to you. I noticed that that's what helped me get over this little thing. Last week I was having some problems with a little bit of paranoia. I have a nosy neighbor. She is very nosy. And even beside the fact that I got over this, she's still a nosy person, okay? But I was letting her nosiness cause me to become extremely paranoid to where I didn't want to go outside. And she's kind of curious about me. She's thinking she knows what's wrong with me. And she's mentioned the words bipolar to me. I didn't ever tell her about it, okay? But she is looking for something. Now, there are people like that in the world. They have nothing better to do. She doesn't work. She's on disability. And so is her husband. And they spend their time watching the neighbors. I'm not the only victim here. Trust me. Excuse me, I have a little bit of cough. I heard from others that they just, you know, that live around them, that said that, oh my God, you can't go outside without them hopping out their front door. I don't live right in front of them. They live down the street. But because they can't really see me without coming up here. But they do from time to time. Come up here and just kind of stand there. Or drive their car up and just kind of sit there. You know, whatever. There's nosy people in the world. Well, bless these people. They're nosy. And I was letting it get to me. And my medications were not being taken at the right time. And I was missing some times because I was very busy. And so I was taking things together when I shouldn't have. And hence entered in a stretch of paranoia that lasted a good week. It was getting so bad that my husband said, hey, would you please stop worrying about what that woman thinks about you? You're not alone. You know, she's this way about everybody. Everybody's on her list. You're not being singled out, you know. And I went, yeah, you're right. You know, I think it's just I need to set my alarms for my medications and take these at these certain times. And I call them medications. I know that a lot of what I take is herbal. It is not truly pharmaceutical, but they're made in labs, and I do get them at health food stores or on Amazon. And, you know, but I call them meds because they are my meds. They are my meds. Herbs, folks, are meds. Don't mistake them for being all natural without side effects, because they do have side effects. They do. Research this stuff. You cannot just assume that, oh, it's an herb, so it's fine. It's got nothing wrong. If it's over the counter, it's just fine. It isn't gonna affect me. Okay, what say about cold medicine and Tylenol and ibuprofen? Those things all have bad side effects if you take too much. You know, right? It says it right on. There's warning labels all over the place. Well, there's warnings on the herbs too. And if you look those things up, you're gonna find out they have new compatibility charts that you can look up to see what can interact with each other, and I do that. You know, but I wasn't, they would say, oh, there's a mild interaction, but not too bad. So I go, oh, okay, I'll take that together just to get it out of the way. You know, a lot of times we do that with the pharmaceuticals. I did that, take a whole handful of pills. They don't work. Why don't they work? Well, because they're all fighting each other. So if you are somebody who has multiple illnesses, let's say you've got diabetes and thyroid and high blood pressure, and you've got a mental illness, and you're popping all this medication, you get up in the morning and you shove it all in your mouth and go throughout the day and you feel like crap and you can't figure out why. Research your medications. Even though I know the pharmacist will say, oh, it's okay. I understand. They go to school for this. Interestingly enough, I've been told that by pharmacists. Oh, yes, it's okay. You know, people do that all the time. Well, that's not my question if people do that all the time. My question is it safe to do that? You know, people smoke crack all the time too. There's lots of folks out there on the street smoking crack. Is that safe? No. You know, so is really putting all these meds together like this beneficial? What if my body chemistry is different than yours? Right? That's the kind of person I am. I ask lots of questions. I get very exasperating for some people because I overthink it. And that's okay. Overthink it because you could save yourself by doing so. So the deal is, overthink it. Look at those medications. Decide if, sorry, I have a spider crawling on me. I'm outside doing this podcast. Decide if they should be mixed. Decide if you, if maybe your body chemistry is different. Things don't work good for you, you know. Look at, see what the best time for each of those medications are. Split things up if you can. I realize that means you're taking things at more times during the day. But if it works better and your body responds better and you have less bad side effects, win-win. It's worth being on a schedule. It's worth setting that alarm on your phone. Because the bad side effects that could be devastating to your body and not fixable, liver damage, pancreas damage, kidney damage, things like that, if you cram all that stuff in your mouth at once, those side effects could be long-lasting, devastating, and, you know, whereas if you split things up, it wouldn't be so bad. And that's what I discovered with this paranoia that I was having. When I fixed it, put my medications in the right order, and behaved myself, and just suddenly, you know, I had the medicines already in me, but I put them in the right order. It was weird how in just 2 days' time, this person who drives me crazy normally drove past my house. I could care less. She drove past my house. She did it this morning. I just saw her pass while I'm sitting here doing this podcast. She drove past my house and she slowed down as she always does to peer out her window, as she always does to see what's going on, as she always does. Normally it makes me tense and I want to run in the house. I didn't do that this time. I don't really care what her agenda is. Get over yourself, lady. You know, paranoia is a truth. It's a sad truth. But, I just went, oh, well, as she drove past my house, which is wonderful, folks. So my medicines do work for me. Like I said, one more time, and I know this is going on an hour and 7 minutes, I think is what this thing says. I know it's been a very long podcast. I'm very sorry. I just felt the need to get this all off my chest because yesterday I had everything so broken up. And when I was talking, I kept having to stop. I kept having to stop. And this time I decided I was going to sit down and lay it all out, you know, that the family history, we'll recap here. The family history was there for me. My symptoms showed up right when I was about 15, which seems to happen for a lot of folks, but they don't get diagnosed until much later. The diagnosis is not an easy diagnosis. It isn't something you just wake up one day and go, well, I just think I'm bipolar. Yep, that's what it is. It's that simple. You know, if you get a good doctor, they will go over your childhood. They'll go over your, you know, they'll look at your family. Now, if you're adopted, that could be different, you know, because you don't have the genetic family history unless you're capable of having that, you know. But a good doctor won't spend only 10 minutes with you to diagnose you with bipolar. A good doctor will spend an hour and a half with you, and it may end up being a couple sessions to really make sure, because this isn't just some kind of diagnosis that, you know. And they can throw your butt in the hospital, too. See, that can happen. It didn't happen for me. Like I told you, I had my friends who kept me at the house. And I was, you know, they helped me with my children and I was being started on my medications and what have you. And it all worked very well for me there. I could have gone in the hospital, but I didn't. There probably should have been some times I went in the hospital, but I didn't. I was the nurse that was just saying, no, I can handle this. And I know there's people out there that have done that. That doesn't mean you don't have mental illness, you know, because I've read, they say, well, if this, you know, the criteria for saying whether you have bipolar is whether you've had things that have caused you to be, there was one criteria I read that said whether or not you went to the hospital or not. And I thought, well, that's not true. Your situation might be different, you know. So your situation might be different. You might have been able to skirt that problem somehow. You know, and a homeless person walking on the street with bipolar that has this and they're living forever on the street, they're never going to get in the hospital. Doesn't mean they don't have bipolar. Just means that it wasn't diagnosed. There's a lot of people walking around undiagnosed that never went to the hospital. And then when they get diagnosed, they get diagnosed, maybe they finally get the chance to get in to see the doctor, and they go in. They don't always stick in the hospital. They don't always do that. So don't let that be the criteria in your brain that you must be hospitalized. Sometimes I think it's helpful. I think it would have been helpful for me. Now my eldest child, she ended up in the hospital. And that's not my job to tell you about her. Someday, maybe down the road, she'll tell the world about herself. But she had symptoms and is now being treated. So there's your genetic component. It goes in families. So it's things that you have to look out for. And she's doing pretty well right now. She's doing better right now since she's getting her help and what have you. But I'm going to end this podcast because it's getting warm out here where I live. And it's nearly noon, and it is time for me to go do the noon lunch bell for the dogs. And I don't want to be dragging this around while I'm doing that. And next podcast that I have, I may not do one for a few days. The next podcast that I have will probably not be this long. I just was like very motor mouthy. I don't want to get it to where people don't want to listen because it's too long. I get a little wordy. I get wordy when I write too. I've had to like condense my stuff. Okay, so this is Ruth Wittstein and Once Upon My Unicorn. Story of bipolar disorder. I use that term, Once Upon My Unicorn. I think that's going to be my podcast title because that is the day when I thought I saw that unicorn. There's the day. I can pinpoint my mother's wedding dress, the unicorn and the fairies in the woods. I'm 15 years old. That, I don't even remember exact day, but I just remember that moment in my life of when I knew something was different about me. Now, mind you, I wasn't diagnosed till I was 32, but I knew I wasn't like everybody else. I could see things that other people couldn't see. Why was that? You know, so, alrighty then. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you all again. Thank you.